Today on Radio Jackie, I'm joined by Bob Gregg, who is an ambassador for the RAF Benevolent Fund. What inspired you to join the RAF?
My father had served. I'd grown up on in and around the RAF and sort of was familiar with it. So I suppose it was a pathway that I was familiar with, but I was very much into sport and activity and wanted to become a physical training instructor. And I wanted to take on the challenge of becoming an RAF PT instructor.
We're going to talk about your accident, but before we do that, can you share a highlight from your time in service? Is there anything that kind of sticks with you?
I think being a physical training instructor in the Air Force, you get to see a lot of different things in the world and travel around. One thing I always remember was a really, really wet, windy, rainy day. I was up the side of a mountain in North Wales with some colleagues, taking them on an expedition. And it was just awful, the weather. But we were sat there and we all were laughing and enjoying it. And it was a realization that the RAF doesn't put you to work 24/7 in defense of the nation. It brings you all together. And it was just there was very much a vibe there. And I do remember today thinking, gosh, this is part of my job and I'm here. And it's a really lovely day. From a work perspective, I think being a physical training parachute instructor in the Royal Air Force is quite a job that covers a myriad of activities that it's very hard to share because some of the things that a parachute instructor would do don't sort of necessarily make it out onto the public domain. And so I struggle to give you a primary example of that. I suppose being involved in sport and seeing people succeed in their activity, that gave me a buzz, seeing my people I've trained and recruits going on to other things, think, yep, I had a hand in that. So, yeah.
Now, I know that something happened to you in 1984. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was 28th of June, 1984, as a parachute instructor, which is a discipline that many physical training instructors get selected to become. I had done so. I was lucky to have done so. I'm proud to be a parachute instructor, hugely, hugely proud. And anyway, I was on a job program at RAF Western on the Green in 1984 I went out last on the helicopter and my main parachute failed and my reserve failed to deploy. And I, then unfortunately hit the ground with a huge amount of energy and sustained a spinal cord injury and sort of a lot of facial damage as well. I was then very fortunate that some of the students on the aircraft were jumping with live equipment, which meant that they had the operational capability to support me, one individual in particular, who thankfully came to my aid and with the assistance of the air crew on the helicopter, they got me to the nearest hospital, which is the John Radcliffe in Oxford, where I was fortunate enough to get treatment that I can't really explain, managed to pull through, ended up with a spinal cord injury, and have been so ever since.
And what are the chances of that happening, both your main and your reserve parachutes failing to deploy?
Quite slim, really. It's not something you can actually prepare for. You can address issues that happen, but you can't prepare for the episode. You can't practice the episode. You couldn't in those days. I'd love to think now with the advanced in technology and simulators that exist in the world that the opportunity does present itself to practice a double malfunction or an entanglement scenario that can occur. But the chances of it, statistically, I don't want to put a figure to it because I don't know and I'd be guessing. Extremely, extremely high. But more so, it's extremely high to survive the scenario. Something that, to this day, I'm in a little group of one. So
yeah, absolutely incredible stuff. And what after that happened, how did you feel in the aftermath, realizing what had happened to you?
Well, I think that comes in blocks, if that makes sense, so throughout your rehab and your life, I suppose. But on the day, I didn't lose consciousness when I impacted the ground, and I knew instantly I was paralyzed. I knew straight away. And I also, as I was endeavoring to resolve the situation when I was falling, I didn't have very long because it was, although we jumped at 6,000 feet, that sounds like, oh, wow, that's very high. It's not in parachuting terms, but at the same time, the first part of the exercise was to be in free fall. So it wasn't until I got to 3,000 feet that this scenario of the malfunctions materialized. And that's only 15 seconds before you impact with the ground anyway. And having operated my main and then had to operate my reserve, the time before I made impact the ground wasn't very long. So it didn't sound like I had time to panic or time to worry. I just had time to do something. And when I hadn't been able to make that happen, I sort of was fortunate enough to be able to present myself in such a way that my feet hit the ground first. And that's how I knew. I just knew. I knew I was paralyzed. And I remember sitting up, and apparently once they'd been able to sort my jaw out a few weeks later, one of the questions that was asked of me is, why did you sit up? And my answer was quite straightforward, because I knew that if I didn't, you might think I was dead. And I wanted the air crew on the helicopter above me to see me moving. And that therefore I had the wherefore to think I've got to let them know. If I was just laying flat from their point of view at 6,000, and they're still at sort of 3,000 or 4,000 feet, they may not have had the foresight to come and land right next to me. They landed no more than 20 meters away, and get me to hospital as quick as possible. So I went into that whole situation. You know, I was then taken to hospital, and then I was into an induced coma, and I was, my medical needs were met. And when I remember when I first woke up, the first person's eyes I made contact with my father, who was at the end of my bed. And yeah, he just said, my boy's awake. And I knew then that life was going to be very, very different. And for me, it's always been quite easy, because I should have died on that day. I didn't. And so do not misinterpret that I haven't got frustrated at times in my wheelchair and things haven't gone wrong and my demeanor hasn't gone dark on occasions. But my out has always been, Bob, you know, I quietly berate myself as I sort of deal with something that's annoying me. And I will bring myself out of my irritation by thinking, you shouldn't be here. You shouldn't be here. It's just not how, this is not something to really get you down. It sounds very simplistic, and people will happily think, oh yeah, but of course I have dark moments. But wherever I am, whatever the scenario, and that has included sitting on an aircraft waiting an hour for them to get myself to disemplane from the aircraft because the luggage handlers have lost my wheelchair. I've always, however irritated I am at that moment in time, I will always walk back on it and think, oh well, it's better that than not being here. So for me to fall south, to fall 6,000 feet with no canopy above my head, it's a privilege to be sat here having this conversation with yourself, let alone anything else, if that makes sense. So I've always had my own little coping mechanism, I suppose.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And do you know why your parachutes failed?
Yes, I do. It was a parachuting error, packing error, and sequence error that was very particular to a certain military parachute that we were jumping with that day. That thankfully is no longer in system, and it went out of system very, very, very few weeks after I'd had my accident, because the same scenario, well, pretty much unfolded with a NATO parachute instructor who was over in the United Kingdom jumping with us, and the same combinations of parachute, as I say, pretty much mimicked what happened to me. And thankfully, the individual didn't end up in the situation I was. But the MOD, a bit controversial here, ensured that that parachute was never jumped again. That's all I'm prepared to say.
Thank you for that. And what were the biggest challenges you faced during your recovery, would you say?
Oh, crikey. That goes from, I went through, I was very fortunate. My rehab was at Stoke Mandible Spine Unit. But in 1984, the limits of the rehabilitation were very much physical. There was attention to your physical needs through physiotherapy. There's a high dependency upon the relationship you had with your named nurse, who would embolden you within just getting dressed, being able to carry out your daily ablutions, going in, prepping a meal, etc. All of these things were managed on the ward in a very physical scenario. And to my benefit, you know, I'm not sort of trying to undermine that, but what was lacking then, there was zero psychological support for not just Bob Gregg, but any patient in the spinal injuries unit. There was no attention to the psychological well-being of an individual. There was no attention to the need for occupational therapist support if you were a paraplegic. That wasn't something that was identified as a need. That was something you'd learn on your own, with your relationship with your other members of staff. And there was no support from social well-being either. So those were the challenges, but they don't all come at once, obviously. They as you advance through your rehab program, other scenario, when you've overcome, a bit like me on the, I suppose, being on the Grand National, really, each time you get over a fence, there's another one just around the corner that you can fall off on. And that was very much how the rehab was. But it was very, very clear to me there. I did touch on that word earlier on, dark moments. I think a lot of patients in that era who had a traumatic experience of not just a spine injury. It's not fair. I don't want to focus on that. The NHS wasn't geared up to offer the psychological support that it does now and the mental well-being. And that led to a lot of inward dark opportunities to present themselves to you, both me and every other person in the 108 beds on the spinal unit. So it was a situation where you had a great day in the gym and your physio and your head, but then at the end of that, you went back and you sat in your bed, and then you got to think, well, okay, where does my life go from here? How do I deal with that? And so it isn't something that is dealt with or wasn't dealt with, and therefore it was always night times became hard, as did weekends, because if you weren't doing something physically, you had a lot of time in your hands to dwell on your own well-being and where you're going in the future. And it was an era and time where you dealt with things on your own, particularly in the military scenario. That still exists quite a lot today, that, you know, you if you've got an issue, you deal with it, you suck it up and get on with it. And so that was difficult. I stand by the philosophy that a spine unit or a rehab unit only gets you ready to leave their double doors. Once you've left their environment, your next 2 years is a very, very, very steep learning curve as you try and reintegrate back into society, back into, if you're fortunate enough, into an employment situation that you can still manage or consider retraining. Because the spine unit, they can't deal with that. And in those days, that wasn't even contemplated, that what you want to go out and have a job, you're in a wheelchair. So all of these things had to come at steps and stages. If I look back on it, it was daunting. If you were to ask me, how did you feel about it? On reflection, it was very daunting, because, as I say, each time you overcame a scenario, another one presented itself. What was I going to do when I left? Where was I going to live? I couldn't return to my own home. It was absolutely not a chance of it being made accessible. And so I was in a very, very fortunate situation, although on another level, it wasn't the greatest of options, that my parents had a property that didn't need any adaptations to make it possible for me to temporarily reside there whilst I decided what to do with the rest of my life. And in fairness, that's where the RAF Benevolent Fund really stepped in for me all those years ago.
Well, that's...
Not that they hadn't already been involved in, with me. They'd been involved without my knowing whilst I was in the very early phases of my rehab, whilst I was still at Oxford. They had undertaken some inquiries and had managed to offset some situations for me that I had no awareness of. And that's something the fund is very good at. It gets on with the job straight away. But the first real time of support from the Benevolent Fund came in the form of a letter when they'd saying to me, when I was at home at my parents, I'd already decided I wanted to go off to college and to university. And they had said, right, just to let you know, when you finish that, excuse me, and you have decided where you want to live and what you want to do, please, please get in contact with us and we will help you find a property. And which they did to this day, all these years later, I'm proud to say and that I'm a housing beneficiary of the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund.
You just touched on my next question there, which was how did the RAF Benevolent Fund support you after your accident? Can you give us an example of how the fund helped you maintain your independence? Obviously, you just mentioned housing. Is there anything else?
Well, I think that's one of the... How the fund helped me with my independence was physical, if that it makes sense. I'd taken myself off to college, so I sort of was self-sufficient in that respect. As I said, I had this letter in my back pocket that whilst I was at university. So the independence was psychological initially because I knew that come the time that I knew where I was going to be living and what I wanted to, where my life and career was going to take me, I would have the support of the RAF Benevolent Fund with regards to the biggest issue, housing, because I do believe that there's a triangle of need that if that is created, then it is extremely possible to be independent. And one is, from my perspective, is to have mobility through the needs of a wheelchair, to have the ability to communicate by travel, so to have a car that is completely accessible, and to live in a house that meets your needs. And those are the three corners of my triangle. And in the middle is me being independent. And so it's so difficult to quantify how important having an accessible property is to, one, your well-being psychologically, but two, to your physical independence. Because by having an accessible house, you can have a front door that you are able to go out of and into the society and to pursue a career. And you have a safe environment for yourself and your family to come home to that you can be a part of, not just a visitor to. And so for me, the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund, the biggest thing they could have ever done was to empower me to be independent by having an accessible property, which, as I'm sat here looking over the garden talking to you right now, I'm delighted to say they have done. The RAF Benevolent Fund have also aided me in the provision of making sure my wheelchair that I have it meets my needs. It's a wheelchair that I can get around in physically, and they help maintain that situation it's been a physical well-being through those two needs, provision, the support in mobility for my wheelchair, and I can't quantify over all the years how important to somebody having being in a house. It sounds very simplistic, but it's so big. I'd be here. You'd need another day to talk to me about the significance of the house. Amazing, amazing.
And how did
it's my front door.
Sorry to interrupt you. How did overcoming such a life-changing event shape your outlook on life?
Well, I would. Simply, I will always, I was at the memorial remembrance parade yesterday in London. I got chatting to somebody and I concluded that, you know, I have to tell you that I've always felt then yesterday and tomorrow that I was a lucky boy on an unlucky day. And on that basis, by defining what happened on the 28th of June, yeah, it was traumatic. It was painful. It was, yeah, it was soul-destroying. But I was a lucky boy on an unlucky day. And so if I, with, and that is not, I've had to, not had to practice that. I've not had to read that. That's just how I feel. I felt that that day when I knew I was paralyzed, but I was still alive. That underpins all my endeavors going forward. And those endeavors aren't always successful. Life isn't full of just a success. You've got to apply yourself and you've got to prepare yourself for things going wrong. That wasn't a day you could prepare yourself for going wrong, but I certainly use that to make sure that when anything else goes wrong, be it having a bump in the car and not having a car for a week, you know, as long as neither I or anybody else is injured, it's just a car. Again, for me, to be here is that's my luck. That was my moment of winning the lottery, as it were, was surviving that accident. So I don't dwell. Yes, I have my moments, and I don't want anybody to think I don't. But again, it's having that. Having the support of the Benevolent Fund is huge for me as an individual, because although I haven't used some of the vast, the myriad of support they now offer, and that is phenomenal, I've not had to, but that's because all those years ago when I had my accident, things weren't as structured as they are today, and I developed my own pathway of coping, I suppose.
And talking about Remembrance Day, what does Remembrance Day mean to you personally?
Huge. I mean, we can't underestimate what everybody gave during the principal conflicts that we refer to in this country as the First and Second World War. But we mustn't forget there have been many other conflicts, and serving personnel are injured or killed on duty in many parts of the world that don't draw the media's attention. And every one of them, every single one of them, is making a sacrifice to the benefit of others. That's never been lost on me. Maybe it's because I came from a military family. I know not. I'd like to think it's deeper than that. So to honour those who have given the ultimate price for it's small change, isn't it? Let's be blunt. If we can't stand in the cold or pay our respects to the cenotaph on one day of a year as a sign of our appreciation of what they gave for us, then are we worthy of what they gave to us? So yeah, I'm very, very deeply believe that we should honour those who, and it wasn't just people in military environments. So many people gave their lives helping on the domestic front, on the home front, firefighters, ambulance staff, train drivers. So many people gave up their lives for the future. And it may sound a cliche, but it's true. Where would we be now if that had not happened? The endeavours had, of all those in the 1939-45 campaign, what would our lives be like now? And what would lives be like also after other conflicts that have happened since then? I'm sorry if I am repeating myself, but it's huge.
And how do you hope the sacrifices of RAF personnel are remembered?
No greater and no less than the other members of the armed forces, if that to be true. Of course, I have absolute undying affinity with the Royal Air Force. But when it comes to remembrance, there may be a lot of inter-service rivalry and banter when we're on the sports field. But when it comes to giving that sacrifice, I don't personally draw a line between one service or another. Am I proud of my service? Hell yeah, very much so. And do I puff my chest out when the RAF contingent went by a little bit more yesterday? I certainly do. And did I raise my voice with my peers from the Parachute Association of instructors known as the Canopy Club went by? I certainly did, and as did they when they saw me. Just remembered with great affection and respect for what they gave as individuals, I suppose, would be my simplistic answer to what you're asking.
Brilliant. And what motivated you to become an ambassador for the RAF Benevolent Fund?
Hopefully, I've little snippets of what I've said. I was so fortunate to survive my initial impact episode, but the RAF Benevolent Fund immediately started working on my behalf. I didn't know about this. I was snugly wrapped up in a hospital bed with a ventilator and God knows what else cables coming out of me. But the Benevolent Fund had already stepped up and started to put into action a plan that would support me and my needs as my life progressed. And seeing the work that they do, and having benefited from what the work the fund has done, if I were to be critical of the Benevolent Fund, it's a backhanded compliment. But the Benevolent Fund struggles. I'm going to get in trouble here. In getting out that message, the Benevolent Fund is superb at dealing with an issue. I don't know the needs of any other beneficiary, or unless that individual tells me. And that is such an important concept. The confidential relationship between the RAF Benevolent Fund and its individual beneficiaries is sacrosanct. And I totally embrace that. I think that is so important. However, getting the message of success out is therefore hindered in some respect by what I've just said. So the opportunity to be an ambassador, I was asked, right, I can take my experience and my story forward and hopefully project it in such a way that it positively reinforces the work of the Benevolent Fund to empower people to think, that's an organisation I would like to support. That's an organisation that I can see is doing good. And from a serving personnel perspective and veterans who are out in the community, by me being an ambassador, I hope that I might inspire a veteran who is in community, who has not had the support they need, to pick up a phone and think, do you know, I think the RAF Benevolent Fund is where I should go to see if I can get some support. And that's literally the case. That's true. So getting that message out is so, so important. And so when I was asked to become a benevolent, would I consider being an ambassador for the RAF Benevolent Fund? My answer was yes. It was multi-layered because I believed in the message that needed to be conveyed. But most importantly, I believed in the organisation and its structure and how it functions today needs highlighting, because as I tried to say, the Benevolent Fund doesn't blow its own trumpet loud enough. And that is not a critical criticism. It's just an observation. How that changes is I suppose a lasting consideration of the chief executive, Air Vice Marshal Chris Elliott, and the chairman of the trustees, Richard Daniel. And I know that they will be doing, they do everything they can to get that message out. But if I can help convey that message as RAF Benevolent Fund ambassador, I'm happy to do so.